as aviation workers have moved towards strike action as well. And similar strike actions were seen across other European countries. Help us better understand the impact that these major walkouts could have overall.
Well, the walkouts are understandable. Inflation in the UK is currently estimated as 10%. It's expected to rise to 13% by October and 18% by next January. So when you have inflation rate of 18%, while your pay raise, whatever pay raise you get, is 3 or 4%, that means you're taking essentially a 15% pay cut. Well, people don't take kindly to 15% pay cuts when, at the same time, food prices, energy costs, and everything is going up. There will indeed be strikes. I mean, that's what happens when people are suddenly taking a dramatic pay cut. And I think that's going to happen in Europe and in Germany also for the first time. Imagine, you know, this was a country that, you know, if you had 1% inflation, the Germans would get hysterical, you know, Hitler's coming. Now they're kind of living with 8% inflation. And now that the Germans are talking about rationing gas for industry, well, that means they're going to be layoffs, and that means pay cuts. In Germany, they do kind of partial layoffs. They don't fire people. They just, you know, give them fewer hours to work. But that means effectively it's pay cuts. Well, people don't take kindly to pay cuts even in Germany, you know, who are much more docile than the British. So I would imagine that the combination of inflation,
sure,
recession, and soaring electricity costs will, you know, contribute. This will be a bitter winter. This will be a real winter of discontent.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Gilbert Doctor, independent international affairs analyst, joining us from Brussels. Also, senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, joining us from Budapest. Thank you for contributing to the program. And also, special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. The cost of energy for British consumers will rise by 80% from October. That's according to electricity and gas regulator Ofgem. This is indeed a dramatic worsening of the cost of living crisis in a country that is awaiting a new leader. And now stark warnings have been issued of a catastrophe and serious physical and financial damage to British families.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. قل إن تخفوا ما في صدوركم بِأَنفُسِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ والله على كل شيء قدير. يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth. And Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and
this is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Informed sources say Tehran is still studying the U.S. response to its amendments made to the EU proposal for the revival of the JCPOA. Two U.S. warships sailing through the Taiwan Strait amid tensions with Beijing over recent visits by American delegations to Taiwan. The death toll from monsoon floods in Pakistan rises to more than 1,000. The country is appealing for international assistance to cope with the disaster. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Bashar Sanjafi. Good to have you with us. A detailed examination of the U.S. response to Iran's amendments to European Union draft proposal for the revival of the 2015 deal is ongoing in Tehran at an expert level. According to Iran's newer news affiliated with the Supreme National Security Council, the process is expected to last until Friday. Washington gave its response earlier this week. Tehran says it will convey its final thoughts through the EU coordinator after a thorough examination. The deal was thrown into chaos when the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Since last year, Tehran and the remaining signatories have held multiple rounds of talks to revive the accord, with the U.S. involved indirectly. Iran has been demanding a strong and durable deal that includes sanctions relief and economic guarantees. Iran has unveiled its latest precision strike unmanned aerial vehicle manufactured by the country's armed forces. The drone named Babil has been outfitted with an optical seeker and a warhead capable of detecting targets. It's also able to capture and relay live images of the targets and destroy them with precision. Iran has made great achievements in the field of UAVs over the past years. In August, Islamic Revolution Guards Corps said that Iran has become an exporter of military drones. Last year, General Kenneth McKenzie, head of the U.S. Central Command, also said Iran's widespread use of drones meant that the U.S. is operating without complete air superiority for the first time since the Korean War. Syria has called on the United Nations and the Security Council to issue a clear and explicit condemnation of Israeli aggressions on its territory. In a letter addressing the UN chief and the head of the Security Council, the Syrian foreign minister recalled some of the recent Israeli crimes, including an attack on the Damascus International Airport last June. It said that the attack caused the airport to go completely out of service for 2 weeks. The minister noted the regime is determined today more than ever to sabotage Syria's infrastructure and endanger the lives of civilians. It said Israeli aggressions are a direct threat to regional and international peace and security, adding that Damascus reserves the right to respond to the attacks. Israel frequently carries out missile strikes on Syria. The latest one came last Thursday when Israeli jets targeted a research facility in the city of Masyaf. Director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, Tim Anderson, explains why Israel keeps targeting Syrian territory with air raids.
I think its main aim is to coordinate with the attacks of the U.S. occupation and the proxy armies, the terrorist groups in other parts of Syria, to try and destabilize Damascus and prevent a resurgent Syria with its support from other powers in the region, particularly Iran, because, of course, it fears that a strong Syria is going to reclaim the Golan eventually. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the next step will be to dismantle the apartheid system in occupied Palestine. But I think the fact that the Israelis and also the US, you noticed recently when they attacked some bases in eastern Syria, they claimed they were Iranian linked. The point of that is, I think, that there's an extreme anxiety that when the time comes for Syria to retake the occupied Golan, it's certain that Iran is going to be its key ally there. The resistance in Lebanon also, it's not clear exactly what role Russia will play, but it's very clear to the Israelis that Iran is going to play an important part in the liberation of occupied Syrian territory and the liberation of Palestine.
The Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip have attended the Friday sermon and prayers in front of the Red Cross office to show their solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. And this as last Monday, Palestinian prisoners started protesting their inhumane detention condition. Ashraf Shannon brings us more from the besieged Gaza Strip.
Hundreds of people attended the Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip in a move to express their sympathy and unity with Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails and detention centers. They came to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners who kicked off a series of protests last Monday against persistent mistreatment inside regime jails. The event is part of the Friday of Rage in solidarity with Palestinian detainees. During the Friday sermon, Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime against harming Palestinian prisoners.
Our military wings, including the Qassam and Quds brigades, and the military wings of all Palestinian resistance factions, are all united behind the prisoners. We will spare no effort to secure the release of the prisoners. Harming Palestinian prisoners is an attack on all Palestinian resistance factions.
Over the past 4 days, Palestinian detainees held in 24 Israeli prisons have refused to take part in security checks and returned their meals. They also organized sit-ins in prison yards as part of their protest action.
The Israeli prison service reneged on understandings that were previously reached with prisoners' representatives. It imposed punitive measures, including moving tens of detainees to solitary confinement, preventing inmates from going to the prison yard, and banning prisoners from meeting their families. In response to this, the Palestinian prisoners have declared the state of general mobilization last Monday.
In recent weeks, the Israeli prison service increased its oppressive measures against Palestinian prisoners by imposing double isolation on some detainees. Observers say the Palestinian prisoners have become propaganda material for candidates in Israel's elections.
Palestinian prisoners are escalating their actions because they demand better detention conditions. The suffering of Palestinian prisoners increases every time the Israeli regime plans to hold elections. Israeli officials are using the oppression of prisoners as part of their election campaigns.
Currently, there are some 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons, and that figure includes women and children. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has detained more than 1 million Palestinians since the Nakba in 1948.
under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Now, in other news, two U.S. warships are sailing through the Taiwan Strait in a move that's likely to raise tensions in the region even further. Three unnamed American officials have confirmed to the media that Navy cruisers Chancellorsville and Anatom are currently in the area. Similar operations have drawn Beijing's anger in the past, and that's the first one since tensions escalated earlier this month over House Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Several other U.S. delegations have since visited the island. China reacted by launching unprecedented military drills near Taiwan. Taipei also conducted its own drills. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory. It's strongly critical of the U.S. diplomatic exchanges, as well as arms sales to Taipei. It says Washington is steering separatist sentiments in Taiwan. But Pakistan has been grappling with monsoon flooding that has swept much of the country. According to officials, the death toll has surpassed the 1,000 mark since mid-June. The government says 119 people have died in the past day. It's declared an emergency and mobilized the military. Thousands of residents in critical areas have been ordered to evacuate their homes. Pakistan has called for international assistance to cope with the aftermath of the natural disaster. Authorities say that this year's monsoon flooding has affected over 33 million people. Nearly 1 million homes have been destroyed or badly damaged. Could you get a clearer picture of the situation in Pakistan regarding this devastating flood? Let's bring in Nasser Kazemi, our own correspondent there. Nasser, good to have you with us. So give us the picture. What's going on there exactly? Why is government unable to cope with this? Is it because of the scope of the disaster, or there are some deficiencies and it's asking for international assistance?
Yes, the scale of disaster is so high, that's why the government is confused on how to deal with such a situation. Let me tell you the fresh figures which I have with me, that sure. In past 48 hours, 120 more people have been killed, while dozens of others injured in the fresh wave of floods in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, Balochistan province, as well as in Sindh, and now the Pakistan's largest province of Punjab is witnessing the high floods. The infrastructures have been destroyed in the fresh wave of the floods in the past 24 hours, and the National Disaster Management Authority of Pakistan is warning of more floods in next 48 hours, and the rains are continued in the areas where these floods are taking place. And as far as the government efforts are concerned, government is trying its best to reach out those people who are stranded in the floodings in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, in Balochistan province, as well as in Sindh province. There were pledges from different neighboring countries, including the Iranian President Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi, called Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif last night. Both leaders discussed the overall situation after the flooding in Pakistan. Iranian President assured of his country's support to help Pakistan in such circumstances. Meanwhile, the Turkish President also conveyed his message for sympathies to the Pakistani Prime Minister. And the same as the OIC, the International Islamic Organization, also appealed the international community to help Pakistan in this situation. So as far as the situation is concerned, yes, the Pakistani rescue workers are trying hard to reach those people out. And now, this is the latest development, that after three provinces of Pakistan, like Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, Balochistan province, and Sindh province, now Punjab is witnessing the high floods. We have reports that tens of thousands of people have left their houses from Punjab as the fresh warnings were issued by the authorities. People are asking to vacate their houses because there are more rains in next 24 hours, and more flash floods could hit the Punjab areas. The crops of Pakistan's
have really damaged, the livestock was damaged in these waves of flood. I was, along with my team, we were on the bank of River Kabul yesterday in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. People were outside their houses. They were not allowed to go to their houses because there were warnings of more floods in those areas. So Khyber Pakhtunkhwa people living there, they are, you know, in a chaotic situation. There has been, you know, a chaotic situation all around the people living in these areas which are near to River Kabul. So the tents have been provided by the government to establish the tent villages, and we have talked to the people. They are asking for more help in terms of food and safe drinking water.
Okay, hopefully the situation can be addressed in the right way and efficiently. Thanks for that, Nasser Kazim, our correspondent in Islamabad. Staying with the deadly flash floods in Pakistan, Iranian President Raisi has offered condolences and expressed sympathy with the government and people in Pakistan. In a phone conversation with Pakistani Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif, Raisi said that Iran is prepared to provide its neighbor with any kind of assistance. The Iranian president said that he has tasked relevant bodies with supplying first aid to the flood-stricken people of Pakistan as soon as possible. He said that Iran remains a friend of Pakistan in times of hardship and seeks to continue bilateral and cordial relations. Sharif thanked the Islamic Republic for supporting his country in times of difficulty. Now, elsewhere in the region, the Taliban are warning against the U.S. drones patrolling the skies over Afghanistan, urging Washington to stop the flights. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid is calling the flights an act of aggression and asking the U.S. to respect the rights of Afghan people. Just weeks ago, U.S. drones targeted a deserted residential home in Kabul without prior knowledge of the Taliban government. Now later, U.S. President Joe Biden claimed that Al-Qaeda ringleader had been killed in that strike. The Taliban cited U.S. drone operations violate international conventions, Afghanistan's airspace, and an agreement that paved the way for the U.S. Troop withdrawal. Well, it was a bombshell, still very hard to comprehend. Britain announced a whopping 80% increase in electricity and gas bills. Now, the immediate question is, how are the people going to afford it? Now, Brits are already suffering a cost of living crisis that only appears to worsen with no relief in the near future.
It has been a rocky economic road that the Brits are traveling on, which continues to chip away at their income. Some were questioning how they would manage their expenses in the UK these days. Why, with an unprecedented inflation and a cost of living crisis, now their nightmare has gotten worse. An 80% increase in electric and gas bills have been announced, one that is coming before the winter season.
It is a major problem because what is happening, of course, is first of all, real incomes are falling because people are not getting wage settlements in line with inflation, but below inflation. Then tax burden has increased, you know, to record levels as well. The government has been raising taxes to pay for the furlough scheme and all the money that they splurged.
To be exact, an 80% increase would mean that it would average about £3,600, or about $4,200 per year from October. And this is terrible news, especially for the poor and the ones at the bottom half of the social strata. The UK was suffering already from high energy prices, in particular heating bills, even before the Ukraine crisis began. So bad was the situation that fuel poverty, as it was called, was leading to deaths for people who could not afford to heat their homes.
If you're poor, you spend more money on energy and food. And so these people are being disproportionately hit. Many of them have already got debt and they don't have any savings to dip into. So it is a crisis. There's no question about that.
These are the stats that are truly shocking that one would not expect from a European country. For example, this article in 2020 pointed out to how thousands of people in the UK died from the cold and that fuel poverty was to blame. On average, there were 32,000 more deaths between December and March than the rest of the year. Many perished because of the refusal of a society with abundant wealth and resources to provide for its most vulnerable citizens. An average of 9,700 deaths each year were believed to be caused by living in a cold house.
We know we need to do more because actually the most vulnerable households have no cushion, have nothing available to them. So what I'm looking at is how I can target that help for those people, not just to January.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
The Islamic Republic of Iran, which is one of the world's leading countries in medicine, high-tech industries, and other sciences, is ready to share its know-how and technology with African countries. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading Iran's Initiative for Reviving Ties with Africa. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Iranian Foreign Minister's trip to African countries heralds a new phase in the Islamic Republic's ties with sub-Saharan Africa, which should help boost economic and political relationships. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, on the first phase of his three-leg trip, visited Muslim-majority Mali, which recently forced the French occupation troops to leave its soil after several years of creating violence and instability. The next phase of his four-day trip took him to Tanzania and Zanzibar in East Africa, which traditionally has enjoyed excellent relations with Iran. His high-ranking political and economic delegation included the representatives of several private sector companies. Recently, Mali had called for an urgent meeting at the UN Security Council to present evidence of France supporting terrorist groups on its soil. France has been a destabilizing force in West Sahara by its interventionist policies in the region and also by arming terrorist and militant groups. With the rise of anti-French sentiments in Mali and several demonstrations against the presence of French military, the ex-colonial force was forced to end its unwanted presence. Abdullahian, during his visit, said both Iran and Mali are of the opinion that instrumental application of terrorism should be set aside and countries be allowed to act independently. The Iranian foreign minister, during his visit to Tanzania, addressing the Iran-Tanzania Business Forum in Dar es Salaam, said, "Tanzania is one of the most important countries in Africa and has always had a special place in Iran's foreign policy. The people and officials of the two countries have a positive view toward each other." The three African nations, that is Mali, Tanzania, and Zanzibar, have all welcomed President Seyed Ebrahim Raisi's efforts to revive Tehran's traditional ties with Africa. There are vast fields for expansion of ties between Iran and the African countries in the commercial, defense, political, cultural, health, and technological fields. This is indeed a good development. It is hoped that other African countries would follow Mali's model and force the French and all other former European colonial forces from their soil. Of course, sub-Saharan Africa ought to be vigilant of American designs, which are also more dangerous and have the poisonous Zionist tail attached to them. The Islamic Republic of Iran, which is one of the world's leading countries in medicine, high-tech industries, and other sciences, is ready to share its know-how and technology with African countries.
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
American immigrant family.
Part 2.
It has been almost 5 months since Yusuf has been imprisoned, awaiting his deportation hearing. It is now just 2 days away. Samir Megahed, Yusuf's father, tries to remain hopeful.
Yusuf's trial is held in the Chrome Jail in the swamps outside Miami. ICE has flown in a team of 4 lawyers to try the case. Yusuf's lawyer, Charles Cook, has agreed to take the case for free. No cameras are allowed inside.
We are currently in the second day of the trial. We just finished the testimony of the government's first witness, both his cross-examination and his direct examination. What's at stake is what young Muslim men in America can do and act like in America today. The reality here is, if you're a Muslim in America, you can't think like everybody else. You can't think like your colleagues. I have another client that we went to lunch with a few weeks ago who's about the same age as Yusuf. And I was telling him about Yusuf's case, and it was very interesting what he said. He had very little sympathy for Yusuf. He says, what is he thinking in America as a Muslim man? You can't go surfing on the internet, look at sites. You can't hang around with other people that are Muslims and talk about Islam. And I frankly find that sad.
David Cole is a law professor at Georgetown University Law Center and an expert in constitutional and First Amendment rights. He says that the targeting of immigrants in America is nothing new.
Historically, whenever the United States has faced a security threat, it has responded by targeting immigrants with its most restrictive measures. And I think that's partly because it's easy to do so. You know, it's one thing to say to American people, we face a greater security threat. You've got to sacrifice some of your liberties and rights in order to protect the country. But it's another thing to say to American people, we face a greater security threat, but we're going to give you more security by sacrificing somebody else's rights, namely, foreign nationals, immigrants, people who have no voice in the political process. We did it in 1919 after a series of terrorist bombs. We went out and rounded up thousands of foreign nationals on pretextual charges, charges of guilt by association. Not one of them was ever found to have been involved in any of the bombings. During World War II, we rounded up thousands and thousands of Japanese immigrants. This kind of anti-immigrant targeting has been a constant feature in the United States at every point that we've had a security crisis. When you want to take action before somebody has actually done anything wrong, well, the criminal law doesn't really allow you to do that generally. Criminal law requires you to have some proof that an individual has either committed a terrorist act or has conspired to commit a terrorist act or has attempted to commit a terrorist act. It requires that you put the evidence on the table, that you give a person a fair trial. But if you use immigration law, you can find all sorts of pretextual charges to use against people. The government employs secret evidence often in immigration procedures. The same sort of fair trial rights don't necessarily apply. The Supreme Court has said that it's permissible to selectively single out people for immigration enforcement based on their affiliation with political groups. So the same sets of protections and rights don't exist, makes it easier to use the immigration process.
Dan Vara was the highest-ranking ICE attorney in the state of Florida from 2003 to 2006. He says that after the September 11th attacks, he began working closely with the FBI. His prosecutions became a model for using immigration courts as an arm of counterterrorism across the country.
2-3 days after 9/11, people like myself got the word from Washington that some of those obstacles that we had to doing some of the cases that we had been preparing for years were no longer there. And we were allowed to move forward and identify people for charges to be taken into detention and to be prosecuted, again, not criminally, but for the purpose of removing them from the United States. In Florida, once we began our work with the Joint Terrorism Task Force and even its precursor, just the FBI and other loosely associated groups, our involvement was day-to-day. We shared, at the height of my prosecution experience, FBI would feed me information every day.
Vara is proud of his work with the FBI and defends the tactic of seeking the deportation of residents against whom no criminal charges can be proven.
Many people get prosecuted and get acquitted, and they're guilty. When you sit at the table with other prosecutors from other branches of the U.S. government and agents from all these agencies, and you're reviewing evidence, I mean, the goal is to find the way to deal with the threat. And if the only thing you have is tax fraud, if the only thing you have is an immigration violation, then, frankly, that's what you use. An immigration charge is administrative in nature. The burden of proof is less than they are in a criminal trial. So even though you got acquitted in a criminal trial, the reality is that the government could still meet its burden at clear and convincing evidence. There are so many people that put their fingers in every single terrorism case that I would tell you unequivocally that mistakes are not made.
In terms of identifying actual terrorists, the government has been very ineffective. So for example, in the first 2 years after 9/11, the government locked up, mostly using immigration powers, over 5,000 foreign nationals, almost all Arab and Muslim, in anti-terrorism preventive detention measures. Of those 5,000, not one stands convicted today of any kind of terrorist offense. So the government's record there is 0 for 5,000.
They don't have the evidence in these cases, and that's what they see as the beauty of immigration court, is heck, you don't need evidence. You just need a judge who's willing to look at all the garbage evidence and make a conclusory statement that I think you've met the burden of proof. Thank you very much. Have a nice life. Arguably, anything is the proper use of the immigration laws. Congress has designed it to be in many ways like the tax laws that cut Al Capone. Well, if we can't get them on the criminal charges where we have to meet this incredibly high burden of proof, we'll just deport somebody on an incredibly vague immigration statute. These immigration courts are part of the Department of Justice. They are an executive. This is not a judicial branch. This is not an independent judiciary. This judge was appointed by a previous attorney general. He works for the attorney general. These FBI agents work for, oddly enough, the same attorney general. The folks that are prosecuting this case at Homeland Security are also in the executive branch. The reality is you have the executive branch being both the prosecutor, judge, and jury in this case. We should all be concerned about that. We should be concerned that there is a complete lack of judicial independence here. Why would an immigration judge, whose boss is the one, presumably, that wants to prosecute and deport this man, say, I'm sorry, boss, you're wrong. Boy, it would take a judge with a great deal of courage to do that.
Many people focus on the Bush administration and particularly on 9/11 and the reaction to 9/11 and on, for example, the Patriot Act. But what you miss when you focus in that way is that this is a broader problem.
Now we're in the middle of the Obama administration. Attorney General Holder has approved this. Trust me, if he hadn't approved it, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So clearly the Obama administration is continuing the same enforcement mentality that first Clinton and then the Bush administration followed in immigration.
There's involvement at the highest levels. The Secretary of Homeland Security, I would be very surprised if that person was not, Janet Napolitano, was not involved in this case. I would be very surprised that if that was the case. Not only because it's a terrorist case, because of the publicity that it's getting.
A local Islamic group is speaking out about immigration officials' decision to detain Yusuf Megahed.
Having a fair trial and the jury finding not guilty, it seems like a slap in the
face. Their backup plan was to punish them in immigration.
Yusuf was arrested for one reason and one reason only, and that's because he looked Muslim.
With Yusuf's trial already underway, protests by community, religious, and civil rights groups continue to grow. In an unusual move, four of the jurors from his criminal trial, including foreman Gary Meringer, begin speaking out on Yusuf's behalf.
This just doesn't seem right.
There are things under the law that were put into effect after 9/11 that allows the government to simply say, we think you're a terrorist, and therefore you will be detained until you have your day in court, and there's no judicial review of that determination. It's just a unilateral determination made by immigration officials.
We didn't know whether Yusuf should be deported or given full citizenship and allowed to finish engineering school. What we did know a lot about was the case we saw in federal court, and based on that case, he was not guilty of anything, whether it's beyond a reasonable doubt or by a preponderance of the evidence, as might be required in immigration court, or by any measure that we saw, this kid there was no evidence that he had done anything wrong. It's like telling the government, if that's all you got, let him go.
I've been doing criminal defense work for 15 years, and I've never heard of jurors going to the media and saying how outraged they are about what the government is doing to somebody who they just stood in judgment of. It's amazing that they would do that. But I think it says something even more about the disconnect between our government policies and what the people who live in this country want.
If I do talk to somebody about this case, what positive can come about it for me? Not forget about Yusuf for a minute. Is there anything good that can happen? And the answer is no. But this is what I need to be doing. I would really like to think at the end of the day I did everything possible I could to get him a fair shake.
I was a history major. And during the pre-American Revolution, what jurors were doing and the verdicts that they were turning down and offenses that were being prosecuted by then the British government was the same sort of thing. It was, we're not going to enforce these laws are wrong, what you're doing is wrong. And that's what these jurors are saying, what you're doing is wrong. You know, the law may allow you to do this, but it's wrong.
What do you think is going to happen at this trial?
Well, based on the evidence that I know of, it ought to be a very short finding of not guilty, but based on what I've heard about the immigration courts, the immigration judges, the influence of the government, the fact they can put on evidence and not even have to show it to the defense, what I think's going to happen is he's going to be found guilty as some sort of terrorist, aider and abettor, whatever, and sent back, yeah, it's funny, sent back, but sent to Egypt, where he hasn't lived since he was, I think, 11 years old.
At first I was shocked because I knew the family very well, and I knew the Mujahid family, I knew their son, I knew how good he was, and I have a son. So I was scared. I told him, you know what, I don't feel comfortable for you. What if they did the same thing to you? So it made me feel unsafe, it made me feel scared for my kids. But I felt like I can't let the fear take over me. And I start thinking, right, you know, we have rights, we're American citizens, that we should fight this. It shouldn't take this route because this is wrong. And if we don't fight now, everybody else are scared, afraid, and they're going to hide away from it. So we thought we could fight it together. And I felt, you know, we can do it. If we as a community work together, we can do it. Give me a kind of, you know, strength to stand up and fight. And the more you learn about your rights, you have to stand up for your rights. We had a privilege to fight for our rights and speak our minds and have the freedom to practice our religion. Not because I'm wearing a headscarf, that means I'm suspect. Not because I'm a Muslim, I'm a suspect. And maybe, you know, with all of us tonight, you know, are united as a community, Muslims, non-Muslims, everybody else. work together to solve this problem. No profiling whatsoever. We will be all safe, because that will be justice.
Yusuf Agadez's family, his mother and his father and his oldest brother, naturalized, but they're having mixed feelings because their son is still being held by immigration authorities. So please make dua for the family and keep tab on the case and support in any way you can.
When anyone in our community or even in a minority community sees this case, especially because this family is immigrants, they see themselves and they see what could happen to them, and I think they're concerned now more than ever, especially everything that's been happening in our community with this case or nationwide. But the main point here is that we have to be aware as Americans, all Americans.
1 week into the trial, just as the defense is about to present its case, the judge makes an unexpected announcement.
The immigration judge terminated removal proceedings. He did the right thing. When the judge walked into the courtroom today, and the first thing he said was, "We're going to go over the exhibits in the case." I knew at that point we had won, because otherwise he never would have talked about the exhibits before I had presented a case. As soon as I realized that, I turned over to Yusef, and I said, I put my hand on his leg, and I said, "You won." I don't think he understood me. He looked at me, and he didn't understand, and Dustin, my co-counsel, leaned in and said, "You won the case." And then his big old grin, "You should smile now," and a big old grin came on his face. He now understands what a great victory this is, for justice in America. The government presented a case today, and the last 4 days, it was junk. It was all about junk. And as a result, the judge finally realized what it was and dismissed it. This is the second time in my 20-year career that a judge has dismissed charges against somebody and terminated proceedings based upon the government's lack of evidence. So this is a very unique happening for me, and really for any immigration lawyer.
Outside the Chrome Jail, supporters and press wait until sundown for Yusuf's release.
I'm very happy for this, and I'm looking forward to go back to university.
I'm feeling so happy for returning my son to spend the Ramadan with us. It is the first night of Ramadan. We feel so happy by having my son to our house again. And I want to send a message for the government that this family of Mujahid, came to this country to live in peace and to work and take their degrees. Let us finish this thing. Please let us, Mujahid's family, live here in peace.
I think it's all over now. I'm happy.
Yusuf is one of the very few who beat their charges in both criminal and immigration court. Despite no charges ever being filed against him, Rabia Haddad was deported to Lebanon in 2003. After being found innocent of all charges, Sami Hammoudi was held by ICE and then finally deported to Palestine. He now teaches political science at Birzeit University. They both say that the America that they left is nothing like the country they were once proud to call home.
When people ask me about living in the U.S., this is before September 11th, as compared to Lebanon or other parts of the world, I would always make the comment that everything else aside, it's still a country of law, where everybody is equal under the law.
I felt happy in the United States because I felt for the first time that I am free to think the way I want to think, to write the way I want to write, to go wherever I want to go. It's the opposite, 100%. I did not expect what happened after September 11.
To this day, the government can walk into anybody's home, into any company, any firm in the U.S., freeze their accounts, confiscate all their documents on the basis of doubt. All they have to do is to say, "We suspect you of terrorist activity."
In the United States, there is no justice. This is what I believe in, and this is what I teach my students. I don't believe that now inside the United States, anyone can say anything he wants. No. The American Muslims and Arabs are not exercising their full rights as other Americans. They cannot. Because they will be punished. And the government has many ways to punish people if they want to. And one time, Ashcroft said, if someone spit in the street, we can try him. We can make laws to try him and put him in jail if we want.
Civil liberties, human rights, the Bill of Rights are all things of the past. This whole matter of democracy and liberty and the rule of law, and it's just a myth now. It's just a myth. Any Muslim or any Arab living in the U.S. and hearing me say this will not think twice about it. They know it, they feel it, they're living it. But I hope that other U.S. citizens don't end up on the wrong side of the fence to find out how bad this USA Patriot Act really is.
The mentality that will harass the Muslims and Arabs, the institutions that will harass Muslims, will harass others.
Measures first introduced against immigrants inevitably get extended and applied to U.S. citizens. So over time, it's all of our rights that are at stake. So the first measures that criminalized speech or that penalized political speech were targeted at immigrants, but ultimately became part of our criminal laws during World War I. The first measures that imposed essentially guilt by association were introduced in the immigration law in the early 1900s, but were extended to American citizens during the McCarthy era, and thousands of Americans were affected by that guilt by association. The first sort of ethnic-based targeting enforcement was against foreign nationals from countries whose ethnicity we didn't like. But during World War II, that was extended, and we ended up locking up not just Japanese immigrants, but American citizens of Japanese descent. So whether it be, you know, racial discrimination or penalizing speech or guilt by association, the measures are introduced against immigrants initially, but eventually get extended to U.S. citizens.
But it created fear amongst the Muslim community, and a lot of people have become so concerned about stepping up to the plate and being an Americans. I mean, being American means that you have to stand up for your rights, that you speak your mind, you have freedom of worship, freedom of speech. Well, none of this has really flourished in our community after 9/11. Most people are scared to come up and speak their mind simply because they've seen what happens to those who spoke.
Controlling the community is controlling their minds, controlling their feelings. They will all the time be watchful, not to say things they like to say. They will say things that the government would like to hear. Not to do anything that they show that they are full citizen who exercise their full rights.
I think a lot of people were just very scared. Like, they wouldn't really talk about things, or they would try to, like, distance themselves. So I think it's more of just trying to get by, trying to live their lives, you know, go to school, get a job, like, just live a normal life and not really so much involvement outside of that.
Back in Tampa, the Mujahid family sit down to celebrate the beginning of Ramadan, their first meal together since Yusuf's second arrest.
I didn't imagine that we are going to sit together with Yusuf in the first day of Ramadan. Welcome back, Yusuf.
I'm relieved. I'm happy that I'm out of this immigration jail. I was kind of expecting it that I be released, but not on a specific date, because the government did not have a case. Like, they were just holding me up for the heck of it. The government is profiling people, they're targeting people just based on their background, not of any crimes they have done. In my case, they of my Muslim background, they were trying to say I'm a terrorist, or that I have to be deported on terrorism grounds. They just want you to sign the requesting deportation and leave instead of staying and fighting your case.
We asked Yusuf what he will do now that he has won. Who does he want to be held accountable for his years in prison? Will he continue to speak out on behalf of others who are facing similar charges? His father, Samir, interrupts before Yusuf can answer.
Don't ask him many questions because the government still now can make an appeal against him.
Do you think they will appeal, or do you think?
I didn't know. They have the right to do anything.
In the limelight. Some commentators think U.S. Democrats have moved too far to the left, too far from the so-called center. We now present you an article written by Robert Reich, a former U.S. Secretary of Labor and a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. The piece is titled, "The U.S. Republican Party is Terrible, So Why May Democrats Lose to Them This Year?" Much of today's Republican Party is treacherous and treasonous. So why are Democrats facing midterm elections that, according to most political observers, they're likely to lose? Having been a loyal Democrat for some 70 years, including a stint as a cabinet secretary, it pains me to say this. The Democratic Party has lost its way. Some commentators think Democrats have moved too far to the left, too far from the so-called center. But this is utter rubbish. Where's the center between democracy and authoritarianism? And why would Democrats want to be there? Others think President Biden hasn't been sufficiently angry or outraged. But what good would that do? After 4 years of Donald Trump, why would anyone want more anger and outrage? The real failure of the Democratic Party is its loss of the American working class. As Democratic pollster Stanley Greenberg concluded after the 2016 presidential election, Democrats don't have a white working class problem. They have a working class problem, which progressives have been reluctant to address honestly or boldly. The fact is that Democrats have lost support with all working class voters across the electorate. The working class used to be bedrock of the Democratic Party, but what happened? During the first 2 years of the Clinton, Obama, and Biden administrations, when Democrats controlled both houses of Congress, they purportedly scored some victories for working families. For example, the Affordable Care Act, an expanded earned income tax credit, and the Family and Medical Leave Act. But they also allowed the middle class to hollow out and the working class to sink. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton passed free trade agreements without providing millions of blue-collar workers who consequently lost their jobs a means of getting new ones that paid at least as well. His North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, and plan for China to join the World Trade Organization, undermined the wages and economic security of manufacturing workers across America, hollowing out vast swathes of the Rust Belt. Bill Clinton also deregulated Wall Street. This led to the financial crisis of 2008, in which Barack Obama bailed out the biggest banks and bankers, but did nothing for homeowners, many of whom owed more on their homes than their homes were worth. Barack Obama didn't demand as a condition for the bailout that banks refrain from foreclosing on underwater homeowners. Nor did Obama demand an overhaul of the banking system. Instead, he allowed Wall Street to water down attempts at re-regulation. Both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama stood by as corporations hammered trade unions. They failed to reform labor laws to allow workers to form unions with a simple up or down majority vote, or even to impose meaningful penalties on companies that violated labor protections. Joe Biden has supported labor law reform but hasn't fought for it, leaving the protecting the right to organize act to die inside his ill-fated Build Back Better Act. Bill Clinton and Barack Obama allowed antitrust enforcement to ossify, enabling large corporations to grow far larger and major industries to become more concentrated. Joe Biden claims he is trying to revive antitrust enforcement, but hasn't made it a centerpiece of his administration. Both Bill Clinton